And hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they are broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at Popular Education. Today's guest has been involved with popular education and organizing for his entire adult life. I just read on Wikipedia that Dennis O'Neill was only 19 in 1969 when he first went to Cuba. I first met Dennis over a quarter century ago because we both have familial ties to a small town in northwestern Connecticut, but Dennis has been a fixture of the left in New York City for over 50 years now. A founder of the socialist organization Liberation Road, Dennis was also on the ground floor of various other socialist groups over the decades, and he's been deeply involved with the many permutations of the anti-war movement, from the movement against the U.S. war in Vietnam to the many imperial invasions of more recent decades. A retired postal worker, Dennis has recently been involved with starting up a group called Save Our Postal Service, which already has twice as many followers on Facebook as Liberation Road does. Dennis O'Neill, welcome to my little live stream show.
Thank you very much, David. I have what I believe is technically known as a checkered past.
A checkered past.
Sure. I think means that I'm not smart enough to play chess, but something like that. So
I was going to ask you about that. But
you've touched on some of the highlights anyway. I will say this, because it's important at the moment, is when I was growing up in Northwest Connecticut, where the town that you referred to, Cornwall, this was a small rural New England town at the time, and we're talking the 1950s. It was largely a Republican town, as New England was at the time. And one of the first things that happened to me to radicalize me, almost all of them were actually involved with that town. Mm. One, for David's sake, was music, because there were some older kids around who were folk singers. And the early 1960s was the period of the Great American Folk Scare. And a woman named Lorraine Chenier, now Lorraine Lee Hammond, was our babysitter. So she would come over with her banjo and do, like, you know, all this 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and a deeper in debt. And, you know, all the stuff that the right wingers used to say about folk music as the gateway drug to, you know, radical politics. By God, it was true.
I was wondering, did you ever take up music, playing music yourself? You did?
No.
Because you have the most impressive record collection I've ever seen.
If you can talk, you can sing. If you can walk, you can dance. I am what is called the counterexample. and I will sometimes be seen lurking in the back, lip-syncing during the singing of the Internationale or something like that. But my political background is has a healthy dose of Maoism in it. And the chairman teaches us, serve the people. And me singing in public.
it's not serving the people.
I don't.
It's a disservice.
Yes, it is a disservice to the people.
Dennis,
but the reason I mention all this is because the first thing I really got much involved in there was some support in that part of the country for the civil rights movement. And I became a little active in Northern stuff around the Black struggle in the South at the time. And as many of us who came up in the 60s, that was a formative experience. And that's one of the things that makes the present day so exciting is, you know, that, I mean, not just it's a huge eruption of struggle, but also I think that for the American left, broadly speaking, certainly since World War II and at a bunch of points before that, going back to at least the 1840s, the Black struggle has kind of taken the lead in what happens in this country. And, you know, for a while that hadn't been the case until Ferguson and Black Lives Matter erupted and stuff. And I think the left was a lot lost in that period because it was the biggest contradiction in American history, and it asserted itself in the form of various struggles. So the fact that it is back to the fore now means that we have a little bit of a compass that can tell us, you know, how to think about what's going on and where to head. So
interesting. I mean, it seems like just, you know, looking at your bio, of course, once you figure out that you're Dennis O'Neill, the socialist organizer and not Dennis O'Neill, the Marvel Comics writer who just died last week.
Recently deceased. Yes. Yeah. R.I.P.
I somebody with a name similar to mine also died. A musician with a name similar to mine died a few months ago, and I got a few panicked messages from people making sure it wasn't me. But the organizations, I mean, there's definitely threads. The threads that seem pretty evident is struggling around the question of racism and the question of imperialism. I mean, it seems to be two of the main focuses in your life as an organizer.
True that, yes.
And that's not a coincidence.
If you set yourself up and say, all right, I'm going to make my life, you know, around struggling against imperialism and racism, it's not a remunerative line of work, but you're never at a loss for things to do. It's
it's kind of like my friend Attila the stockbroker, you know, he travels around doing his tours as the on the schedule of his favorite local football team, and his favorite local football team always loses, and and so it's kind of a, you know, you don't end up feeling victorious at the end of it, but you've participated in a lot of good efforts anyway.
It's right. Well, I still have hopes that, you know, at some point in I wish people would pick up the pace a little bit, but I really would enjoy to see, before I assume room temperature, the armed seizure of state power and the establishment of the cooperative commonwealth. I'm not holding my breath, but it would be nice.
It never quite seems to get there, but I don't know if it's a moment at this point yet that you would call a hopeful moment, but it's certainly a moment with pregnant with lots of possibility, huh? And I wonder, just like, how would you? I know it's a massive question, but give an effort, give a stab at sort of summarizing the current historical moment and how it feels in comparison with other. I mean, people are constantly making comparisons with the 60s. I don't know how appropriate these comparisons are, but it's like all over the corporate media is 1968, 1968, you know. So just you were there. Can we hear something from somebody who was there?
Actually, it's, well, I've been, you know, I, there's this fish that they sometimes catch off the coast of Madagascar called a coelacanth. I wish I had a picture of it to bring up, but it's this horrible, gnarly, toothy looking thing that has not evolutionarily changed in hundreds of millions of years. And every time, you know, the fisher people there drag one up, there's usually a picture and an article that says living fossil found. And so I have some young friends for whom I kind of play the role of living fossil. I am a coelacanth. And I always talk to them, you know, people want to know, what was it like in the 60s? What was it like, you know, in the Vietnam War movement, when the urban rebellions were like, you know, you the Panthers, you knew Panthers? Yeah. And, you know, you felt a little bad because, you know, besides having the best music, we had a really interesting time to come up and a time full of struggle and full of learning, you know. And I mean, our learning comprised making a lot of mistakes. And we did that. I could talk for hours about the mistakes that we made, but I felt bad for young people. And now what the hell? You guys have a bigger upsurge than anything I've seen in my lifetime. If you combine the elements, we have a global pandemic, the like of which has not been seen since 1918, and which is being horrifically blown by, you know, the reactionary incompetence of the Trump administration. We are in the early stages of the deepest depression since the 1930s, which is just starting to manifest itself in a way that people are going to be dealing with for some years to come. And in terms of its impact, the comparisons with this that are made frequently are after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, when there were like 140 urban rebellions. Those didn't last as long as this. They were part of a larger whole, but in terms of what's going on now, it has more legs than that. There's May 1970 when student activists, mostly white, shut down the America's campuses, took them over, you know, ran them for a month, et cetera, and, you know, basically put the final stake in the heart of the U.S.'s efforts in Vietnam. You know, if you go back before, if you say this is bigger than that, and it's certainly shaping up to be, I don't know when since the Civil War you would talk about something of this magnitude, possibly the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, where the working class ran the city of St. Louis for 5 or 6 days and railroad traffic in the whole country was shut down. Red flags flew on the Bowery in New York. But this is big, and we don't even understand how big it is now.
It's one of these things that's so big that it's a problem I find for like trying to even talk to people who are not historians, you know, because actually nobody has seen anything like this confluence of circumstances, at least as far as I can tell, since like at least being a history buff myself, like in the 1840s in Europe. Is actually what you know comes to mind, because it's not like we're having peasant rebellions with tens of thousands dying and monarchs being beheaded yet, but what we are seeing is this confluence of a massive economic depression coming on the heels of basically a sort of a natural calamity kind of, which it wasn't natural. The pandemic, it's a combination of sort of human and natural, like the 1840s, like the potato blight in Europe, which was also kind of a natural phenomenon, but also largely an unnatural kind of a combination kind of thing. And then with a depression following it, and then rebellion. And so it's kind of this combination, because in the 60s, for many people in the U.S., particularly a lot of white people, it was a prosperous time period, very unlike now.
Right. Prosperous and secure. I mean, you know, people, many people felt, you know, society's on the up and up. We'd come out of the war, you know, all of that. And there were these currents underneath. But, you know, people were, there was not what you see now in terms of a legitimation crisis of some sort in people, you know, questioning the legitimacy of all the institutions of capitalist society in this country, which people are doing now, the government, business, everything. And they're questioning them from the right as well as the left. And they're actually being encouraged and egged on to do that by quasi-fascist forces. But, you know, it's very different, very different.
It is, isn't it? I mean, because it seems like people were always, many people, like I would dare say you and many other people who are organizing at the time, would have been hoping for the kind of involvement in the movement from the sort of white working class and other, that would be quite the kind of like dreaming for the 1930s is the feeling I get from a lot of 60s era activists who are like accomplishing a lot of things, doing a lot of organizing, but always wishing for that kind of movement that people had in the 1930s. And I don't know what's exactly happening now, but clearly the questioning of the most basic tenets of capitalism and policing and many other things. It's mainstream now. I'm having trouble getting my head around it when I turn on National Public Radio and I hear them talking about defunding the police. They try to minimize it and try to kind of narrow the conversation down. It seems like there's an effort to minimize the sort of scope of the conversation, but it's not necessarily working. I don't know. That's it is really. Do you wake up in the morning and just like wonder what country you're in sometimes?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and it's not just that, but you know, the nice thing is it's gone global. You know, the things that are happening here have reverberated around the world, and people are finding, as they did, you know, during the Vietnam War period, you know, there was a huge movement globally to stand with the Vietnamese against U.S. imperialism. But that also prompted people to think about what was the relationship of their ruling class to countries in the third world, to liberation struggles and so on. And people developed, you know, targets of their own, you know, clearly in the UK, for example, the whole question of, you know, half-stepping and antsing around about white domination in Southern Africa became a major movement in its own right that continued on after the Vietnamese had won. And I think we're seeing that kind of thing around policing, around racism, around a whole bunch of issues in countries, not just in Europe, but in Asia, Africa, Latin America. So who knows where all this is going to go, but sure is interesting.
It sure is. And then also, like just trying to put it all together in terms of the current historical moment, as we recall, before the pandemic, there were massive uprisings going on in multiple countries at the same time, like Chile, Ecuador, Bolivia, Lebanon, Sudan, Algeria. I mean, so many different countries all at the same time, and not necessarily all around the same issues, but largely around questions of division of society into the rich and poor and austerity budgets and just decades of life, living standards decreasing and the rich getting richer and all this. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, but trying to put this all into some kind of context in terms of like, also, the pandemic obviously exacerbated these many divisions in this society and many other societies. But one of the things that's been going on, I guess mostly since the pandemic hit, has been wildcat strikes and rent strikes, particularly around New York City. And I don't know if you've got much of an impression of how widespread that kind of stuff is. It's with the internet, it's often, I find, and I think many people find, difficult to kind of figure out how widespread these things are.
There's a lot of motion, a lot of churn. I think we're in the early days of it, and to refer back to the 1930s as the, you know, V-shaped recovery that, you know, Wall Street and the Trump administration and so on are praying for fails to materialize. You know, people's situation is getting more desperate. I'll remind people that in the 1930s, it wasn't strikes that kicked things off. You know, it was the unemployed councils, which it seems to me is something that people might look into a little bit for organizing models and thinking about it, because a lot of their work had to do exactly with rents, with evictions, with those sort of things, and with demands for relief, you know, food, money, the stuff that people need to do. And that was a period, you know, those, many of them were led by the Communist Party, but also the Socialist Party, the Musteites, who were Christian socialists of a vague description. And yeah, all kinds of people were building these unemployed councils. And, you know, for 3 or 4 years, those were actually the main forms of struggle that took place. But gradually, people who got their training, you know, both in activism and in political understanding in those, found jobs. And by 1934 and 35, you had the beginnings of the great union upsurges, which, you know, were really, in some ways you could argue, were triggered by general strikes in Minneapolis and San Francisco and Toledo, but all of which were successful in those cities, and then went on to the big union drives of the CIO and so on. So it's a... You know, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And if we're in a period now where people are going to be desperate about having enough money to, you know, put food on the table, about not getting evicted and so on, it may be that, you know, big strike movements aren't the main form that things will take at the moment. On the other hand, I'm not going to draw conclusions. I know people who have been working for several years on Amazon, and they say it's blowing up. You know, there's mm-hmm. several unions are involved in fairly well thought out, you know, resourced national campaigns. And then there's all these independent support things, you know, among lefties and decent-minded people, you know, Amazonians United and stuff. And so, you know, we'll have to see how that goes. That could be something that's very different about the moment.
Dennis, can you talk a bit more about the movement of the unemployed workers and the rent strikes in the 1930s? I mean, I know you were not there, but it's you have been in New York City since the 60s, and I think there's one of the things about history is, of course, there's lots of great books that have been written about the 30s, but you know, as those of us, including me, who are old enough to have known people who were in organizing in the 30s, you know, there is that direct connection. You knew a lot of people who were organizers in the 30s, because as you know, they were the backbone of the left, you know, long after the 30s, you know, throughout right. Especially around New York, but all over the country.
Yeah, well, it was huge. I mean, people, you know, people are in desperate situations, you know, their job is gone. The government services that used to function are not functioning. And people have to respond. And if you have a core of people who are doing organizing, you know, you build up a movement. And one of the things which is those movements were also characterized, and I think it's important. You know, we now highlight some of the more militant struggle aspects of them, but they also had a strong aspect of what we refer to today as mutual aid, which is something that, you know, comes out of various, you know, anarchist and quasi-anarchist traditions in the U.S. in the last 20 years anyway. But, you know, people need help. People also want to help. So they organize themselves to bring these things together. And it is not an easy or a simple thing. I was involved in some stuff, mostly online, early on in the pandemic, before even the economic crunch became obvious, where people were trying to organize mutual aid stuff. And some people were able to do it and do it very capably. And other people were like, you know, I have a bicycle. Where do I get food and where do I take it? And, you know, but people learned through the course of that experience. And I think those, the more successful of the mutual aid projects, and because I'm on lockdown, I don't get intimately involved with them, but there are some fairly impressive ones in Brooklyn and in cities around the country. You know, you just stumble across them when you're trying to figure out what's going on. Those are, in some ways, you know, the seed beds of already of struggles around rent control or no rent, around so on. And I think that the reason I raise it as organization, the form of unemployed organizations, unemployed councils, unemployed workers organizing committees, whatever you want to call them, over just rent struggles is, we shouldn't forget that an awful lot of Americans actually own their own homes, or technically own them, and the bank owns them. But as we learned earlier, the bank will not necessarily be quick to repo if they don't have somebody they can sell it to or rent it to. That comes as the economy recovers a little bit. So I think that by focusing it around unemployment, and all these issues fall into that, it seems to me, you know, government services as well. On a guess, that would be a good way of framing this stuff. But let's see what happens in practice. I'm very, like you, I'm kind of watching. I think a lot of us are. We're just looking at what's going on and trying to figure it out.
Right. Folks, you are tuned to Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, Wednesday through Friday every week, along with other broadcasts I hope host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU, Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel and at youtube.com/drovix, on Patreon at patreon.com/davidrovix, and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. Dennis O'Neill, why does Trump want to destroy the U.S. Postal Service, and what are you trying to do about that?
Well, there's a quick shift from the general to the particular.
yeah.
it's good, as we old Bolsheviks say.
You know, that's always my reaction to every time somebody asks me a question is a sigh.
I have enough to rub together, frankly. So I think the sparks have a hard time making the jump. So there are a couple of particulars to it. The first is that, and I think this is why the Postal Service, the struggle to defend the Postal Service, and earlier we were trying to expand its scope, it's the commons, right? It is something that all Americans feel a part of. You know, they may grouse about it and stuff like that, but it's theirs. It is not corporate. People do not feel, you know, oh, you know, let's see, we have a new X-Men movie, or we're going to go to Disney World, or whatever people did back when we went to movies and Disney World, right? You know, and, you know, Disney makes me, it's not the commons. It's not mine. It's a commercial thing that provides you with entertainment and stuff. And I think that if you look, there was an interesting poll just taken by Harris that said, it asked people, what company do you think has been the most essential during the pandemic? And the Postal Service came in first. Mm. It's the only one that isn't a for-profit institution, either, quote, publicly owned, i.e. by stockholders, or privately owned, i.e. by rich motherfuckers. It is, you know, simply, it is the people's. And that's part of the reason. They had four different questions. I don't remember all of them, but touched on different elements. And one of the questions was permanence. And it was, in that category, the question was, you know, which of these institutions do you think would most damage the country if it were not to survive? The Postal Service came in first in that, you know, so I'm in it, obviously, partly because I'm a retired postal worker. I don't know if you can see my sheet, U.S. Mail, not for sale. I've been working on this stuff since I stumbled into working for the Postal Service, and have been fairly active. But this is an entirely different kettle of fish, because you have the government or the administration basically actively out to sabotage it. And I think there are different elements. First of all, I think that some of Trump's economic advisors are, you know, it's like disaster capitalism, you know, the Naomi stuff, you know, it's like, if we can just, you know, if we can just make things bad enough for the Postal Service and kind of collapse it, we can break it up and sell off the bits, some of which would be enormously profitable. You know, the kind of venture capital firms that specialize in commercial real estate. The Postal Service is a dream.
Yeah, they own property.
Buildings, block, whole city blocks all over the place that could be, you know, torn down, put into play, built, you know, so, and that's just one example. There are other, there's the delivery business, there's the so on. So those people are saying, yeah, you know, let's go, let's privatize. Trump, of course, has made it very clear that why he's got the knife out for the Postal Service is that the Postal Service does a lot of last mile delivery for Amazon. And whatever you think of what's his face and of Amazon in general, the Washington Post has certainly gotten, you know, it's like having several burdocks in Trump's underwear. He can't sit down or move without getting really upset. So he wants to, he's demanding that the Postal Service charge. And, you know, we actually have, because of the huge popularity and utility of the Postal Service, one would think that this would be very hard to pull off. And indeed, oh, I should say, and we're broke. And there's two things. One, there's this thing called the pre-funding mandate, whereby Congress voted to make the Postal Service pre-fund some of its retirement benefits 75 years. 75 years. I mean, we are talking about a situation where the Postal Service is supposed to contribute into this huge fund, which Congress winds up borrowing from somehow, you know, but they'll pay it back on us. For people, workers, retirement benefits for workers whose parents have not even been born yet. Do the math. I mean, it is phenomenal. If you did that to any company in this country, I don't care who, IBM, you know, huge, well-capitalized firms, General Motors, you suddenly told them they had to pay their retirees' benefits 75 years out, they would be awash in red ink the next day. I mean, it's just, you can't do it. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that the Postal Service is, you know, runs on kind of, it's not a for-profit institution. So it's kind of a pay-as-you-go deal. And with the exception of that funding, mostly, most years, the Postal Service runs in the black. And people don't understand that. Because a lot of stuff that the Postal Service used to do, you know, bill payments and so on, people now do online and calling grandma and so on. But we still do a very large, I say we, they, whatever, a very large volume of letter mail. It's the main thing the Postal Service does, as well as parcel delivery. And so what's happened in the pandemic, especially, is that parcel business has gone up considerably, and you'll see pictures of trucks, you know, stuffed to the gills with packages. What you don't see is the collapse of letter mail. Because if you think about going to your mailbox, a lot of what you get is business mail. Some of it's first class mail. You know, it's, you know, hey, your subscription to Bass Fisherman's Monthly or Jacobin or whatever it is that you're reading has gone away. Some of it is standard mail, which used to be called bulk business mail, and which I will get chided for saying, but you know, I was in my 30s before I got a postal job, and so I was badly trained. People call junk mail, right? And you get that in your mailbox, but all that mailing has been shredded. If you are sending around mailers saying to people, you know, here's a coupon for $2 off at Chirping Chicken, right? Well, you're not doing those mailings anymore, because guess what? All your Chirping Chicken outlets are closed while people are on lockdown. Same thing on a larger scale, you know, come down to, the local auto dealership, and we'll give you $4,000 off on your old clunker if you buy a brand new 2020 model, you know, whatever the hell it is, Subaru, SUV.
There's just so much worse business.
That mail is just not coming. And that's our bread and butter. That's the Postal Service's bread and butter. So all that income has evaporated, huge chunks of income. And at the same time, the Postal Service has additional expenses. They're having to hire more people to replace people who are out because of COVID-19. Either they have cases or, you know, their kids have suddenly been dumped out of school and child care and they have to stay home, you know. So, we negotiated, the unions negotiated memorandums of understanding with the Postal Service that would pay for, you know, people to be able to do this for a matter of, you know, some weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, they get part of their pay so they could survive and then come back to work. So you have this catastrophic shrinkage. Okay. So early on, we went to Congress. And in the first stimulus bill, I forget the name of it. They all have these stupid names, you know, the Heroes Act, the, you know, whatever. But the first one where they gave, you know, $1.5 billion to rescue airlines, banks, cruise ship lines, you know, whatever. They actually tucked in $25 billion for the Postal Service. And it passed not just the House, but the Senate. And there's a reason for that. The post office is very important to a lot of Republican politicians, senators, who have constituents who are old, who are veterans, who live in those flat states where, you know, rural communities have kind of dwindled. So the post office is the only local place left, right? And so they tend to vote for the post office, given the option. So the House and the Senate were both prepared to pass this $25 billion. Not enough, but it would carry us for quite a while. And Trump sent Steve Mnuchin, the little toad who is running the Treasury Department, there to tell Congress that he would not sign the bill if there was any money in it for the Postal Service.
It's just sabotage.
And in you know, one of those profiles in Courage, for which Congress and the congressional Democrats are so famous, the House and the Senate both folded like a cheap suit and let the bill pass without it. The next one, they voted a $10 billion line of credit, kind of a loan liner like you get from your bank that the Postal Service could have, but would have to pay back. And Mnuchin promptly said he wasn't going to release any of it unless changes that Trump wanted, mostly quadrupling the rate that Amazon pays for parcels, for shipping parcels, were implemented. So here we are. This is now 3-4 months on. The money is running low. Nobody really knows exactly when it runs out, but it becomes increasingly urgent because there's one more reason that Trump hates the Postal Service, which is vote by mail.
Right.
Right.
Is this like a way to sort of try to take over and make sure the elections don't happen? Or
let's just say there are Republican Party strategists and donors and stuff like that who are reading the polls and sweating profusely, who would be awfully happy if the Postal Service folded before the November elections, because then everybody would have to go vote, or maybe they can't, because there are five states in which all voting is done by mail now, including your home state, right?
Yeah, Oregon. Yeah,
home state. Mm-hmm. Right? Aren't you?
Yeah, it's all vote by mail. Yeah,
it's all vote by mail. Incidentally, my coworker on this project, Jamie Partridge, says hi. if the states couldn't vote by mail because the post, then maybe the election would have to be postponed somehow. So, you know, there's a lot of evil gamesmanship going on here. And it's, you know, besides those five states, of course, many more states are passing laws that they're saying, all right, we can't institute vote by mail right now, but we can institute anyone who requests a mail ballot for any reason will be sent one. And, you know, in some states like Michigan, they're sending out announcements. The secretaries of state are sending out announcements that say, if you want to vote by mail, just fill this form out and send it in and we'll send you your ballot come the election.
Right.
Very easy, make it really easy, which leads to one of the most bizarre cases of Trumpism that I have seen so far in a period which is full of them. There was a demonstration in, not Cedar Rapids, that's Iowa, something, Grand Rapids, Michigan, last Friday, in which a bunch of Trump fans burned their applications for mail ballots as a protest. They set up a brazier on the state capitol They weren't armed this time, but, you know, they burned these to show that, you know, their contempt for the idea of mail balloting, which you would be, of course, ridden with fraud and therefore. And, you know, I mean, it's encouraged by those who will want to claim if and when Trump gets catastrophically defeated that, well, it's because the election was stolen. But, you know, I mean, you talk about shooting yourself in the foot. To me, that's right up there with going to Trump rallies after signing a little thing that says, I won't hold the Trump campaign responsible, you know, if 2 weeks from now, you know, I'm lying on the sofa in the living room, hacking out chunks of trachea, wondering when 911 is going to come, you know, burning your vote by mail application. Very strange.
Is there, as I understand it, although, of course, the idea that if it's easier to vote, then more people will vote. And if more people will vote, then the presumption is the Democrats do better, right? But I don't know if there's any actual evidence that voting for mail even benefits the Democrats.
No, most of the studies that have been done don't indicate that. Now, you know, you've got a galvanized population of, you know, African Americans who are, for some odd reason, you know, pretty fired up and extraordinarily unlikely to vote for Trump in this historical period. So it might lean that way. But, you know, one of the five states is Utah, which is a reliably, you know, I mean, they return Republican, you know, electors to the Electoral College, you know, senators, high Mitt, you know, governor, you know, it's on and on. It is a red state, as they are known. And, you know, the fact that they've got vote by mail, the main effect it had is Utahns, I think they, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's Utah with an N. Utah citizens, before this, they instituted it because the voting rate there was actually lower than the national rate in the United States, which is pretty disgraceful because we have a very low voting turnout compared with most countries. They instituted vote by mail, and now they're 3 to 4 points higher, percentage points, than the national average. You know,
and they're still electing Republicans.
Vote makes it easier to vote. That's all. You still got to do your get out the vote and your advertising and all the crap that the political parties do to turn people out. But there's nothing that says, well, if we only had national vote by mail, you know, the Republicans would never win again. Although Trump evidently thinks so. He said that.
So. Interesting. But so what would you be, I mean, if the post office is going to just sort of fall apart through lack of funding rather than be like ended in some kind of, you know, fell swoop or something, what do you think that would look like? Because it seems like it's already happening. I mean, I know so many people who have been waiting weeks and or months to get a piece of mail that normally would take a few days. Interestingly, including many, many copies of the Fifth Estate anarchist newspaper that were mailed out in March, in early March, many of which have not arrived anywhere that they're going.
That is true. And it's happening. I mean, you know, it depends. The Fifth Estate is still out of Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Detroit has been pretty hard hit. One of their major sorting facilities was closed down. And sometimes, you know, a lot of this is up to regional or local postal management. Some of it is up to the initiative of postal workers. But a lot of letter carriers just said, you know, look, we got to get people their actual letters and we're not going to, you know, do the grocery store flyers or whatever it was that they're doing. We're just going to let that stuff sit for a while. And it's presumably still sitting. Mostly it's pretty good. I mean, I know people who have I'd say probably about 80% of the mail gets through in a relatively timely fashion. You have to bear in mind that the erosion of your postal service has been going on a lot longer than this. One of the things that happened in the teens, the 20-teens, and even back into the aughties was postal management shut down a lot of sorting centers. Like there was one here in the Bronx. Mail that was mailed in the Bronx would get sorted there, and we had a next day delivery guarantee for the five boroughs, right? They shut that sorting center down. The mail had to go down into Manhattan or up into Westchester County to get machines sorted and sent them stuff. And the next day delivery guarantee was permitted to evaporate. And that has happened in a lot of places. So, and now with as you get outbreaks of infection, we've had, you know, some thousands of postal workers, you know, my union sisters and brothers, and also some managers actually, come down with COVID-19 and been exposed to serious cases. The death rate, I think, is still in the two figures, but it's climbing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, bear in mind that most postal workers are not in the most risky group of the over 60s, you know, over 70s. Most have retired then, by then, like me. You know, we've lost a lot of people, and some of them are hotspots. I just got a thing on a Facebook group that I administer. It's a private group for postal workers to respond to the crisis, that they have four positive cases just turned up in one facility.
And people are working in mail sorting facilities in relatively close proximity to lots of other people, right?
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, I mean, they're trying, there's trying to be an improvement in that. And, you know, I mean, let me be clear on this. I believe that the men and women who move our mail are the beating heart of the American proletariat. Also, some of them are kind of a little dense. We got some Trumpies and stuff, and we got a lot of people who don't like to wear masks. And it's a constant fight inside facilities. You know, wear a damn mask. I do not want my mother to die because you're uncomfortable or because you read something online that says masks cause, you know, COVID-19. It's not the coronavirus, you know. Just, you know, have a shot of bleach, put your mask back on and take it off when we're done working here, please. But those are major battles. And so, we're not, and partly it's in a lot of places, management won't enforce it. Mm. And if management doesn't enforce it, people use that as an excuse. Well, I don't have to. And so, you know, we're in some places what the union is doing, my union and presumably the others, the American Postal Workers Union, is saying, if someone is working next to you in close proximity, not 6 foot distanced almost all the time, you should file a dangerous working conditions thing and a request for leave and give them to the supervisor and say, I'm out of here. I'm clocking out. I am not coming back until this is rectified. You got to have a strong local and union leadership, which will back you up, which here in New York, we do, the New York Metro Area Postal Union, which is the largest local in the American Postal Workers Union. It backs up the workers who do that. But, you know, you also got to have some heart because there are pressures from coworkers. There's pressures from management. So it's a constant battle now.
You know, speaking of that constant battle around, which is, I mean, in many, there's so many aspects of the sort of struggle for the hearts and minds of people. And one thing I keep thinking about a lot is especially in the context of the struggle around rent and mortgage deferment, rent strikes, mortgage deferment, cancel rent, all this kind of thing. Is there's real divide in society, it seems, on so many different fronts, but between those that believe that the fact that they have to pay exorbitant rents or mortgages is just the way it goes, and that's just how it is, and they should just deal with it, and if they can't do it, it's their fault. And then there's a growing number of people who are realizing that the system is rigged, but it seems like there's still this, well, there still clearly is this huge divide between what I think what Mao called the rich peasants and the poor peasants. And I wonder if you could talk about that a bit. I really like that that term. It seems very appropriate. You know.
Right. Well, it's and it saves us from getting into nitpickery about, you know, what exactly did the great thinkers of the past mean when they said the aristocracy of labor, you know, and were they talking about union officers, union members, you know, people who had a couple of shillings to rub together, you know, we don't know. There are people who are, now that is going to be a major question that we're going to be facing in the coming period, because the depression is going to start hitting people hard. And you're going to have two sets of responses to that. One is the traditional response of a considerable section of broke-ass people that goes, you know, I mean, a lot of studies done on this in the depression and stuff. It's my fault. Yes, there's a depression on, but somehow I have failed to insulate myself and my family sufficiently, etc. I mean, that's something that people doing organizing in those sectors are going to have to deal with. And then, you know, among people who are, you know, have got, you know, two hands on an upper rung and a foot on a lower rung, and are sort of moving that other foot around to see if there's something in place they can put it down so they'll really be sure. You know, there's a certain amount of, you know, I'm all right, Jack. You know, I'm doing it. But I'll tell you, one of the interesting things about the current moment is that there is a lot of solidarity among union workers and even some, you know, locals and pieces of the union bureaucracy with the ongoing Black Lives Matter eruption. And the more that takes place, and the more that you watch the discussions that are taking place, you know, online and in various fora and so on, the more you see people are getting, you know, that the thing, the initial shock that I think caused all of this to erupt, which was in a 3-week period, we sort of had, you know, a set of edifying reruns of what gave rise to the original Black Lives Matter thing. You know, you have Trayvon, you know, killed by a white vigilante, revisited in the case of Ahmaud, run down and shot by a white vigilante. You know, you had Rihanna, who was killed in the by cops, you know, in plain clothes, breaking into the wrong house and shooting her up, which had happened a number of times and could have stood for all of those. And then you had somebody being choked to death, visibly at length, live, couldn't miss it on your television. And I think those things were the spark that set off the prairie fire that we're seeing now. But if you look now, people are really starting to understand and talk about, and by people, I mean more conservative people of color, and also a surprisingly large number of white people are talking about, you know, black people really do get fucked in this society. And it's an everyday phenomenon, and it's not going to go away unless something is done about it. How long this moment will last, what kind of gains we can make with it, and this gets us into the dicey area of electoral politics and stuff like that. But, you know, how long that lasts will be interesting, but it's definitely happening. And if we are laying the basis of solidarity among sections of the population who are not, don't fall into the most oppressed and are not just, it's not just sort of a, you know, what would you say? You know, a nice Karen, Lady Bountiful, capital G, capital W, capital P, good white people approach, but is done in understanding and solidarity with what's going on. You know, it lays the groundwork for what are going to be a some difficult years to have that kind of solidarity to breach it. Because the other thing to remember about the Chinese experience that you talked about is you base yourself in the poor peasants. But the strategy is, you know, you unite the advanced to win over the intermediate and isolate the backward. And that's, I think, kind of what we're going to be figuring out, who falls in any particular struggle and more broadly on a society-wide basis into those categories over the coming period. And there were plenty of, you know, rich peasants and intellectuals and, you know, landlord families and stuff like that that produced revolutionaries under those circumstances. So we have to keep our eye on, you know, the advanced and making sure that who we're isolating is narrowed. You narrow the target.
Hear.
That. So.
And with that fantastic advice, Dennis, I'll just thank you for joining me for the hour. And there's about several dozen other questions I wanted to get to, but we'll just have to have you back. And
I'd love it. And, you know, maybe next time we can get into the contentious, you know, question of voting fascism.
Yeah, that was a whole other subject I wanted to get to. The Sanders campaign.
I figured for sure you'd be bringing that up, but I guess you're.
I was planning on it, but it's
softening me up.
It's always hard to bounce from one subject to the next and figure out when to cut people off and all. I'm a big fan of the longer form, but I guess going longer than an hour, we'll start losing people.
We'll
talk about the election soon. Thank you.
Big fun, David. I really enjoyed this.
About the election soon.
Thank you. Okay. Me too. Take care. And thanks everybody for tuning in to another discussion with David. And that was a conversation with Dennis O'Neill in New York City, founder of Liberation Road and Save Our Postal Service, among other organizations. You can find all these discussions archived in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovics, at patreon.com/davidrovics, at soundcloud.com/davidrovics, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovics. I have a new album out on Bandcamp, which you can stream for free, called Notes from a Failed State. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free. But if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my community-supported art program or CSA at davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Tomorrow, I'm very much looking forward to talking with longtime rabble-rouser, founder of Global Exchange, Code Pink, and other wonderful organizations, a woman who has been arrested in more countries than even a well-traveled tourist will ever have a chance to visit, Medea Benjamin. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.